Now, last time I tried to tell you how the war was built into people's lives, how they coped with the unparalleled confrontation of mass death and life in the trenches by lifting it either into the sacred or into the trivial. When I talked about lifting it into the sacred, building this kind of bridge, I tried to tell you that this was connected to two things, to the stereotype of the hero, of the young hero, which continues in a certain way, the rediscovery of the body, the idea of Arcadia, of innocence, the idea of flowers, and then the design of military cemeteries. And I ended last time by saying something about the greatest experience for all of them, the experience of camaraderie, wartime camaraderie in the trenches, and that this idea of camaraderie became an idea of equality, that the officers, the second lieutenants, who were also the mismakers of the war, the writers, all of this sort of thing, how these second lieutenants believe, which may or may not have been true, that the relation between them and their men was indeed a democratic relationship in the front line, in the trenches. There is actually a lot of truth to that. All of them became a society of mail, a Bund, as we say, of mail. It became a kind of male stereotype. Let's have the next picture, Ken. Which I think we can see quite clearly in this. Well, you have to. It's all right. Yeah, good. In this war bond advertisement, In this war bond advertisement in the war, which makes it quite clear the man, the woman, and the child. I don't have to tell you anything more about the place of women in this affair. The man is again this kind of stereotype we've talked to all along. Can I have the next, please? Which you have here, which is a 1938 cover of an SS racial calendar. And what is different between the war bond poster and the SS Nazi poster is just that the man is nude. Which shows you again the Nazi emphasis upon this kind of stereotype, or this kind of nude stereotype which you have there, while the man in the war is still clothed, but otherwise it's directly taken from the war bonds poster. Thank you. Thank you.
He also has a breast.
Yes. Now, with all of this then, we have the ideal of comradeship, we have the ideal of a stereotype, we have the ideal of equality, and in this way, the beautiful body and the beautiful nation are linked. But the beautiful body and the beautiful nation are linked within a general ideal of camaraderie, a concept which after the war was to come politically alive as the myth of the war experience. To come politically alive in putting forward a new way of governing, a new way of governing through this male camaraderie, through this natural leadership, through this camaraderie of affinity. It became, after the war, through the myth, an alternative of government for a great many people, something which is often forgotten. It was, in the end, a much more powerful alternative in Germany than the Soviet alternative. There were, after the war in the Revolution, talk about it later, Soviets in the German Revolution. But in the dark, even the Soviets in Germany had a lot of wartime camaraderie about it. And somebody asked me about this. And even the leadership of these council of workers and soldiers were often in the hands of former second lieutenant, of former frontline people, as much as they were in the hands of actual working class people. So many people saw the council of workers and soldiers after the war in the ideal of camaraderie, but of course the people who saw it above all were the right in Germany and Italy, where it made a difference, those who had after all lost the war itself. Now, if the lifting of the war into the sacred was one way to confront it, one way to receive the war within you, to cut it down to size, leading to a new political principle. What about the other process, the process of trivialization? It's about that that I must speak today. This was determined to a certain extent in the First World War, that it was the first war in the age of photography, in the age of film, and above all, in the age of mail service and tourism. Now, the age of mail service is especially important because this is a war of postcards. And the home front sent postcards to the front, the people in the front sent postcards back home. These postcards were mostly staged. They were not actual photographs. But they were used, as it were, to draw the sting of the war. And I want to show you two of these postcards which make it quite clear how the trivialization breaks the horror of the war. Next. Now, this is the man having a good time in the trenches. Actually, a postcard very bouncer. A man having a good, and the postcard which was sent from the trenches to the home front says, we will persevere with God for King and Fatherland. Now, I don't have to tell you that the actual dugouts didn't look anywhere like it, and nobody had a good time in the dugout. But this was a way, as a way of bridging it, of trivializing the situation. And what you have here in dugouts, you have in war literature. I've told you already in England that when Kipling writes about his journey in the front, whenever the shooting starts, Rudyard Kipling talks about the wonderful smells which came from the kitchen in the dugout, which of course had no kitchen at all. Most of the people had trench feet. The next one is still more telling, because I've told you about the sacred, the Easter. Can we have it up a little? The Easter. And this is Happy Easter from the front. Well, several things that I want to point out. Okay, several things I want to point out. This is obviously the Easter Bunny, and this is obviously the man in the trenches behind him. Now, here all these things have been fused. Arcadia. The landscape is undestroyed. It's an undestroyed Arcadian landscape with woods and even the Easter eggs in what would be no man's land, you understand, in reality. And the bunny who looks there, the whole is a scene of Arcadia. And I remind you here again of Walter Flexus, Arcadia, of Rupert Brooke's Arcadia, of the idea of Arcadia behind the front. And this idea of Flex and Vulture lying in the fields nude, the boys bathing poem, the soldiers bathing idea, is directly related. And here you have Easter trivialized. Easter was made sacred in the idea of resurrection of the fallen soldier. Oh, what an Easter means! That Germany is resurrected, the soldier is resurrected, but here obviously it is trivialized. I don't have to tell you. Okay, thank you. I don't have to tell you. Now, the war was the first war in the age of mass tourism, and that indeed is important also for the process of trivialization. But as I told you once before, and I can't spend much time on this, mass tourism was a new thing in the 19th century. Not mass pilgrimages. The pilgrimages to Lourdes in the 1860s, this new miracle of Bernadette and Lourdes, the healing miracle, that pilgrimage had 300,000 people. So that was already a considerable mass tourism. But this was mass pilgrimage. And the importance is the line, for our purpose too, between pilgrimage and tourism. Well, in 1864, around you have French publications saying that people are now also traveling for the pleasure of traveling. But that was quite new, whether you think of the Grand Tour of the 16th and 17th century, which was for the purpose of education, or whether you think of the pilgrimages in the 19th century. they had a definite goal. But now you get the idea that you travel out of curiosity. And when you travel out of curiosity, organized by Thomas Cook and Son, a firm which started in 1840, by the way, so you see how recent it is, organized by Thomas Cook and Son, you do get something that I mentioned before. The landscape and the people in it become a myth. They become stereotyped. The happy Levantine, the dirty Italian, the lustful Frenchman. All of these things become myths and stereotypes because the tourist doesn't really see the landscape and the people. The tourist makes a myth of the landscape and the people. And Ronald Bond pointed out not so long ago quite correctly. So you have, therefore, this kind of tourism developed rather fast after the war, very fast after the war. And this has something directly to do with trivialization. For it has to do what became of the battlefields. If the battlefield is tidied up here as Arcadia, with the Easter Bunny, the battlefields were tidied up in real life. And the battlefields of Flanders became a part of mass tourism, which took their sting. For example, there were Cook's tunes, Pullman seat, superior hotel accommodations. One hotel advertised the best hotel in the salient. Well, in the salient, 300,000 people had died. And now, at that space, there was a best hotel. Gratuities included experienced ex-officers and guides. And at the same time, the next picture, no, give it for a minute, as the Menin Gate, which I'll show you in a minute, was erected as a permanent memorial to British soldiers, next door for one franc, you could inspect, and I quote, Death Trench kept up as during the war. So the whole thing became a tourist event. Tidied up. The landscape itself was tidied up as well. For the landscape was given back to the peasants. And where it wasn't given back to the peasants, it was cemeteries. But the cemeteries, as I told you, were very tidy, park-like places. So if you wanted to see a war landscape, it was ghettoized. You paid entrance, and there a death trench was kept up as during the trenches. You can still do this today, by the way. That still is there today. It's picked up during the trenches. Now, all of this was a traumatic experience for the people that fought in the war when they came back. For example, Henry Williamson or H.A. Mottram in England bewailed the fact that those fields have been tidied up, planted with shrubs and trees, destruction. What they called, we are deprived of our landscape. Our landscape has been reconstructed. Now that again made the war palatable. It made a bridge between war and peace. Karl Kraus, the Viennese humorist, called this death trips to, called it tourist trips to hell. But the whole idea is these were not tourist trips to hell. These were tourist trips to a tidied up landscape, which was bereft of the war. And such visits had to become surrogate horrors. For example, there's one description by the German War Grave Commission of young Germans in 1927 being led to the battlefield. And the description says, we can no longer get any sense of the battle. We'd better go to a cemetery and see. And there we have at least a sense of the joy in war and the joy in resurrection and how the dead speak to us after the war. In other words, the only horror you could have there was what we might call surrogate horror. That is true. Now, not only that, but what you have here in tourism is gradually pilgrimage to the battlefront was becoming tourism. When that happened, it's very difficult to say. The only thing we can say is this, that in 1927, the British organization, which gave free pilgrimages to St. Barnabas Society, ended it, because the St. Barnabas Society said there aren't enough pilgrimages, from now on there must be tourists, so let Thomas Cook and Sons handle it. So around 1927, the curious must have outnumbered the pilgrims, to the battlefield already, which tells you something else about the acceptance of the war itself. Now, side by side, could you look out and tell them to talk somewhere else outside this classroom, yeah? Thank you. Beside this, of course, one can take these mediations in any kind of list or order that we want to take them. It is quite true that if you look at war literature, it is the adventure story which really predominates. Here again, war is an adventure. And even if you read the anti-war books, like All Quiet on the Western Front, All Quiet on the Western Front was read by most people just as an adventure story. Just as an adventure story. That's probably why it sold so much. It's a good adventure story. So even war literature became more and more adventure stories, really, than having a kind of saying to it, a kind of anti-war message, many of them. Moreover, it's quite clear that this happened even during the war in England with children's books. In England especially, the war was adventure stories. There's a war poster to urge you to enlist. Remember, the British Army was a volunteer army. And one war poster said, enlist in the war and play football for England. In other words, the analogy to sport and the analogy to adventure was quite direct here in England, where sports played such a great part, but elsewhere too. You can do it through the theater. If you see it, there's a study for this in Germany, but it's no different everywhere else. During the war, the theater continued light comedy, military comedy, a kind of narcotic effect. The war plays, if they're serious, dwell on the theme of death and resurrection. But they like to look at the bright side of things. Thus, for example, we have an English play where a boy's lungs have been destroyed by the war. As his mother visits him in hospital, it says, look how happy he is and how much he's looking forward of showing his Medal of Merit, his Victoria Cross, which is the English equivalent of the Iron Cross. So it always was a bridge to draw the sting of this kind of horror and this kind of idea of plays. The circus was important in this in France, because the French circus reenacted entire battles. France had a great tradition of mass play and mass theater. In fact, there was one theater in Paris which was mass theater ever since the French Revolution. It had 200, 300, 400 people on the stage. And that was now used to reenact battles, the storming of the city and so on, with a patriotic, upbeat ending without, of course, any death. Moreover, and can I have the next picture, sir? Children were used in the war as well. I'll show you. This is the main gate at the city of Ypres, which is still standing, of course, built as a war memorial, where to this day, and in fact throughout the Second World War, it's interesting, throughout the German occupation of Belgium, taps are played every evening for the dead in front of the men engaged, and the Germans respected that, of course, even during the Second World War. But this is actually the opening of the men engaged. Yeah, thank you. Now, this is a typically children's picture, the war of children. And the text with this picture is as follows. We can learn from children. Children are not ambivalent. They have sheer joy in battle. Children do not complain. They take what comes and enjoy it. That was totally correct, of course. In other words, using the primitiveness of children to make the bridge to the war. Now, what isn't typical here, I told you, these children have guns. I should have shown you one with swords, because the innocence of children goes with swords, with the imagery of chivalry, again, not the imagery of guns. But children were once used everywhere as an example. An example of how a warrior should be, joyous and unquestioning, as children play games. Now this means that the war was connected to games, and indeed it was. It was. both in the matter which I can't talk about because I don't have time, war toys. War toys were something new. The first mass-produced tin soldiers don't come only in 1910. And there's a whole literature of how children can now use tin soldiers in the war. So there are war toys, and there are war games, really board games, domino games, card games, and all of this sort of thing. In other words, the war is integrated into leisure. And this is, I think, extremely important for you to remember, because people's leisure time is, after all, important. And so it is integrated into leisure. Thank you. It's integrated into leisure time. But when you have the war integrated into leisure time, what about then the film? Doesn't that cut through? And the interesting answer said it could not cut through, because in the First World War, you couldn't get the camera into the trenches. So all pictures were staged. And that means you could stage them in an upbeat manner. I mean, it's kind of the thing Lyndon Johnson would have loved during the Vietnam War, if you couldn't have gotten the camera into the war, yeah? But here it was really technically, you couldn't get them into the trenches. And so the newsreels usually end with happy scenes of the war. And indeed, the films about the war, as it were really military comedy. That is, the soldier could now marry his sweetheart. Before then, the girl's father denied him her because of snobbery, but in the war, all snobbery ceases. In other words, military comedy sort of encouraged the myth of equality, which you had between the men, officers and men as well, because usually it's a guy who's in love with a girl, and the father's girl is of higher social status, and he refuses him the girl, but in the war he has to give in because the man comes back with an ironclad first class, or with the Legion of Honor, and so on, until he finally gets the girl, and it's that kind of upbeat stuff that you have here in the films as well. Moreover, during the war you have a wave of detective films as well, which are of course sheer and narcotic. On the whole, we must say that the film did not really help make the war more realistic. That it was also integrated in helping to bridge the horror of war to cut it down to size and become the problem. So is photography. Because after the war, you have a whole series in All Nation of picture books about the war. Hundreds of them, about which young boys, like myself, let's say, poured very sad that we were too old to fight, too young to have fought in the war. We could not prove our manhood. I enlisted in the Spanish Civil War later. I came too late. I come too late for all wars. Now I'm very happy. In those days I was very annoyed, and because it was a way of not proving your manhood to come late to wars. So, in other words, what happened, therefore, these picture books. But if you look at these picture books in a more obvious way, what are they? They again tidy up the war. The most famous one, Jünger's The Face of the War, for example, says, we must feel behind the horror the pulsating nobility of German fate. Or as another one puts it, one must use one's power of will to see here not merely the horror, but beyond the battle, the power of will of Germany. Now, in France it's similar, but when they say the horror, the only horror these picture books show are burnt villages. They will never really show you a dead corpse. They will show you the destruction of things, but by and large, never almost. I can't really think at the moment of hardly one example, the destruction of people. So that it's quite nice for kids to see villages burn. Who of us hasn't wanted to put the torch to something? Yes? So there's nothing wrong with that. That makes war more exciting. But if you had a nice decaying corpse there, so if it were, you might have drawn the excitement, yes? Because you certainly didn't want to be that. But these picture books, by and large, were also upbeat, so that photography, by and large, did not really, in the First World War so much, bridge matters. I know that in the Civil War, the American, it's different. In the American Civil War, photography did show some of the actual horrors of the war. But in the First World War, I think you would not really find that much at all, as far as I've been able to discover. At any rate, and certainly not in these kind of picture books. Now, to be sure, together with that, you had a lot of other things. Soldiers made of soap, Hindenburg mugs, Joffre chamber pots, all sorts of things that make the war familiar. Yes? All that sort of thing that made the war familiar. And yet, there was, of course, a conflict between the sacred and the trivial. There was a conflict between these two ways. And I told you, this conflict can be seen on the one hand, through the controversy whether the headstone of soldiers' graves should be mass-produced or not. Mass-producing, of course, trivializing. But you can see it otherwise as well. In the constant exhibitions during the war of art and the war, they usually call it art and the war, and they try to warn the population before what we call in Germany war kitsch, before, you know, Hindenburg mugs and Joffre chamber pots and all of these kind of things. They try to show you or to warn you against that, to warn you drawing the war or the war experience into the trivial. They're not consistent, because usually they praise war toys, and they will praise some artifacts more than others, those who were in better taste, those who were done according to the arts and crafts movement, let us say. They did praise, they were not consistent, these exhibitions. But by and large, there was a fear, just as that whole dispute about tourism to the battlefield again shows you the kind of dispute between the sacred and the trivial, which is, of course, fundamental to religion, fundamental to anything sacred. It's the same dispute which led Luther to break with the Catholic Church. It's the same dispute that you have in any religious thing between trivializing and the sacred. And how far you can go in that, you have in the war as well. Now, in this process, then, in that process, neither won. In other words, obviously, you weren't going to defeat the trivialization process. Because after all, when all is said and done, the process of trivialization is one of the more fundamental processes of our whole culture. We've often talked about that, that people need symbols, like Rupert Brooke or Vosher, or these flaming youths on the war memorials, or war memorials, or state capitals, or God knows what, or saints, because people have no power of abstract thought. People, by and large, can only understand what they can actually touch. See? Therefore, it's no good, and Huizinga said that for the 15th century, I remind you, to make general statements. It's no good to make general statements. You have to make specific. And the specific is visual, by and large. Now that is taken care of in the face of the war experience. Through the First World War, the nation found a new church. And the new church of the nation is the military cemetery. And the war memorial, which is usually an inner church, in any case. If it is separate, in the middle of town, or wherever it is. It's not only that the nation found a church, it is also, in a sense, that the basic Christian rhythms of our civilization, which is a Christian civilization, were encouraged. And you find oddities. You find, for example, a correspondence between American War Graves Commission and the head of the American Jews, Louis Marshall, during the war, where the American War Graves Commission said, we want to bury Jews separately and we want to take away the cross which is on their graves, because on the battle everything was done with the cross. And the chief Jew of the United States, Louis Marshall, says, no, these Jews must be buried under a cross, because not to do it you would destroy their camaraderie with their other fallen soldiers. And similarly, if you go into any British military cemetery, under the cross of resurrection and the altar in between lie Jewish graves as well as Christian graves. In other words, the Christian symbolism became all-pervasive. There is no doubt about that. Even if Jewish graves have the Star of David on their headstones, they still lie in the shadow of the cross of the resurrection. So you have a Christian symbol, all pervasive, of course, and the cross here is. Now, at the same time, of course, you have the war then cut down to size, in everything from postcard to the world of toys. And the new media actually worked to trivialize. That's, of course, true to our day. The new media have trivialized from the beginning. The film, photography, have not always been used to show reality. They have usually been chosen to disguise reality, as you well know from television. To disguise reality, to make reality into a myth, and to transmit the idea of heroism. In the Second and the First World War, in the Second World War, Tail Gunner Joe, I told you that already, that plot of Tail Gunner Joe, the kind of, in that war, in the Second, in that American movie, the hero, an aviator, typically enough, I told you what that meant, appropriation of field of eternity, chivalry and all this, and the aviator comes back from death, he's shot down, he comes back, and he flies with his successor, and he encourages his successor to marry his wife. So this is Clark Gable. However it may be, the idea is still there, that you have there, and therefore here, that it is a kind of disguise through symbol and myth. Now, what is the result of all of this? It means, first of all, I think, a certain brutalization of the modern mind. A further brutalization of the modern mind, the acceptance of war is not so frightening, not so bad, cut down to size and adventure to a certain extent. Now, I know this didn't work out because people went into the Second World War with the greatest reluctance. But still, it's still an underground river, that the idea with which so many of the generation of 1914 went into the war, war is rejuvenation. War is revolution. War is rejuvenation. War is the festival, the extraordinary. That became part of the myth of the war experience, even after the war. War is rejuvenation. Through the myth of the war experience. Moreover, it became part then of a political alternative, a new kind of society, a society of men, a society of virility, a society of camaraderie. The thing fascism became in the end, but thing that the left also competed for to succumb in some ways, but competed rather unsuccessfully for. Moreover, beyond that, we must say that the myth of the war experience created a new kind of class conflict in Europe, much more as important as the other class conflict between rich and poor. The conflict between the frontline soldier and everybody else, between the frontline soldier and the base, was transmitted into the peacetime by war veterans organizations, most of whom at first, like Barbusse's communist one, were only open to frontline soldiers, and only eventually became open to everybody else. But at first for a matter of frontline soldiers, in Italy, for example, they were always separate. And while the usual veterans organization in Italy and France supported the Third Republic, in Italy the frontline veterans organization supported Mussolini. The real veterans organizations expelled Mussolini and gave him his most chattering political defeat in 1919. But these frontline veterans organizations are called, of course, fascisti, that's where the name comes from. These frontline veterans organizations were always tended to the right, except in France, Barbusse tried to take them to the left without much success. This is important because the left had a great difficulty with the war experience for many reasons. First of all, because it was anti-war. And it had a long anti-war tradition. Even if it voted for war credits, it was still rhetorically reluctant. And secondly, it was too rational. It had too much rational into it. It could never forget it. In fact, the German Communist Party was so idiotic as in the end try and center its veterans' organization on the Red Army. And it was called a complete bust because their experience had been in the German Army in the First World War. And you couldn't certainly say to your own veterans' organization, no, you have to identify with the Red Army. That meant nothing to them. And so you can't redirect this loyalty, this experience. And so, of course, communist veterans' organization in Germany collapsed. It just couldn't be done. The Social Democrats were a little more successful because they allowed the wearing of orders and decorations at socialist meetings. And eventually the communists went all the way around and encouraged at meetings the wearing of First World War orders and decorations as anti-French rhetoric. Eventually the communists jumped on the bandwagon. But still, if anything defeated the left in the Germany and Italy, it was that it could not deal with the war experience, which for most of the articulate population had, after all, been the one experience, great experience of their lives, as I have told you before. What happened in a more general way in the myth of the war experience is something that I think can serve very well to sum up as far as we've gone, namely that myth becomes reality. After all, this myth of the war experience is a myth. The reality was got off. Trench feet. Terrible trenches. All the horror of the war. Treading on the dead. Treading on their stomachs so that their insides came out. Getting used to the green and yellow faces lying around you. The war was quite different. But it is the myth that lasted. And myth can become reality. And in this case, it did become reality. So that you must realize that it isn't as crude that the workings of what we have studied, of course, as you know, man is what he is. But here the myth is the driving force, of course, for very real reasons. The reasons are real. Myth and reality interlock. But the reasons are not in this powerful myth, which was destined to win out in many European politics. By the 1930s, nearly win out in all European countries in the Depression. In the Depression, people, many people, not all, but many millions, went to this myth to rejuvenate themselves, their society. Not to the myth of the class struggle. Not to the myth of the class struggle. This was the great counter-myth, and it's the counter-myth that was successful in Europe. So, we must say that here, the reality, what was the reality? The reality was an existing reality. The war was dreadful, the first encounter with mass death. But it was also a psychological reality to come to terms with the horror, to somehow transcend it, because you didn't want to forget it. You didn't want to leave it behind. It was the high point of your life. It was the high point of your life. And it was no good people telling you, well, you should have a loyalty to the Red Army, or you shouldn't wear your order and decoration because war was bad, as the socialists did. Most people refused to accept that war was bad, something they had laid their line on the line and suffered from. You couldn't just tell them, as the socialists did, war was bad. They had to have something more to it than that. The socialists could have done it if in the end, let us say, a revolution had come out of it. But no revolution came out of it. So that somehow there had to be an upbeat to this experience. And this must be clear. And so, in other words, the tenure and the alternative of post-war politics were decided. In many ways, the great wave of sports, which you saw in Kuala Lumpur in the movie, is partly there. Many of the right thought sport, especially in France, sport was the alternative now. There was no longer war to steal the body. Now there is sport to steal the body. And the French author Henri de Montaigne has a very influential book in which he shows men doing athletics and then women coming in and being again the disturbing factor. In other words, it is still a male society. In the midst of the war experience, with its emphasis later on sport as a substitute for war, sport as a substitute for war in Germany and Italy, for example, the films after the war, The Path to Beauty in Germany of 1921. Let's see the next, I think, I don't know whether I put a shot from that film in or not. It's a very popular film. Shows, first of all, no I didn't, but leave it on and lower it. That has to be lowered quite a bit. The idea of sport as Greek in this film, for example, you have to lower it still more, I'm afraid. Important is as important as the top. The idea of the sport means, in other words, that a male society means all of this once more. And with the male society in sport, you have the idea, of course, that sport steals the body, as I was saying. In this film, you have all the statesmen doing sports. I mean, you don't know all their names, but all the European statesmen. But the main scene is a scene of Greece in a Greek stadium of naked and half-naked men doing Greek gymnastics. There again you can see the stereotype through gymnastics, through sport. Now I can sum it up by the most famous picture that came out of the war, which I show you now. Now this picture, I didn't show you. What did you do? What? Yes, we need a picture. No, this picture. This picture is both the final picture in a very famous book about the war, and it was famous in the war. And what it is clear, it's a statue of Christ. But it is one of these so-called miracles which happen in every war, that in the middle of the battlefield, his cross is shot away, but Christ remains standing. His cross has fallen, don't you see, in the left. But Christ remains standing amid all the destruction. Now, there were several Christs like that in the war. The most famous one, I think, was at Amiens, where the whole city was destroyed, but the Christ on top of the cathedral somehow remained intact. There were three or four Christs, by the way, in the Second World War, too, in the First and the Second World War. But this is the most famous because it became, through photography and through postcards, the most famous. And again, I think it sums it up very well, that you have a landscape of destruction. I don't know if you can see it. In the back, a village is alive, yes? And here you see destruction. The cross is shot, but the symbol of resurrection is alive. In other words, all the destruction has an upbeat ending. It is, as we would say, using now Frankfurt School vocabulary, because I've used Frankfurt School method here all the way, it is a mediation between you and the war. It is a mediation, the mediation of Christ, which I think is as important as the mediation of trivialization. Yes?
How is the church to be acting?
The church is of no importance in this whatsoever. And it completely, by and large, Catholic priests were more impressive than Protestant ones, because Catholic priests were encouraged not to be separate, to enlist with the men. But by and large, the official church is very much second.
What do you mean second?
It's not important. It's not very important. It doesn't revive after the war, you see. Nothing to do with it. There are certain literature about war Christmas, but by and large, no. Of course, they took advantage of this, but these are all secular, or secularized even. They may say they missed their golden opportunity. Perhaps they did. The church were conservative. They preached for God and King and Fatherland and all of that sort of stuff. They didn't preach any of this kind of stuff, really, to that extent that you would think they did. Now, what you have, therefore, here is this kind of symbolism. Not reinforced by the church, perhaps indirectly reinforced by the church, but not mainly reinforced by the church. Though, again, it's a good question. The church, in a certain way, fastened on to all of this. It tried to jump on this bandwagon, but not with any great success. Eventually, these are secularized methods. Now, with all of this, we have now come, obviously, to the post-war world. And it must be clear to you that the First World War was a kind of funnel in which ideas from before the war were funneled to after the war. That in the First World War you had this kind of bridging process going on, this rejuvenation. And that out of the First World War came a praise of youth, and that youth as a concept will be strengthened politically and becomes a political concept and a political weapon after the war. That people are now afraid to grow up to maturity, are afraid to be fathers of family, are afraid to integrate themselves into a bourgeois world which was doing for them. This, of course, much more in the defeated than in the victorious nations. In France and England, this had relatively little impact. In Germany and Italy, this had a great deal of impact. And in all of Eastern Europe, we must be clear to make the difference. It made a great difference whether you won, or you were defeated, or you thought yourself defeated, as Italy did. You have the impact in one series of nations or another. But I am suggesting that though this is true, still underground, the acceptance of war, the symbolisms of war, kitchen, the myth of the war experience, really implies is for everybody, everywhere. Except that in England and France, it did not become a successful weapon. In other words, Oswald Mosley didn't make it in England, and of course the Leagues did not make it in France either. And if the Leagues did not make it in France, it is because the loyal veterans remained loyal. In other words, if fascism did not come to France, if France barely missed fascism, it is because of the loyalty of the French veterans movement to the Third Republic. You see, it can work otherwise as well, the other way around. It is the loyalty of the veterans which kept the French Republic. Now, on Monday we shall come to the post-war world. But I also please your papers on that. No extensions have been given.